Hey, Colin here. We just launched our Patreon, so if you want to support the show, head over to patreon.com/Colin Stuckert. That's patreon.com/ColinStuckert. We will have exclusive updates coming. It will also give us more opportunities to invest more in the show and release more shows. Some other bonuses with the different tiers. Check it out over at patreon.com, and thank you for your support. Another way that you can support the show is you can head over to Wild Foods and use code AMPODCAST12 for 12% off your entire order of real food, superfood, supplements, and ingredients. These are products that I've been using myself in my daily life for years. I recommend checking out our fish oil and our collagen, and also make sure you check out the Co-Tropic. It's one of my favorite products. Cocoa, mushrooms, delicious. Head over to wildfoods.co and use AMPODCAST12 for 12% off your entire order.
In order to optimize your diet, you have to have honey, you have to have organs, you have to have this, this, and this. And then people are like, holy shit. Mm-hmm. It becomes a lot when I'm like, that's not ancestral eating, right? If you have to
like optimize everything, right? We couldn't have done that in nature. Let's just go all the way back to the beginning. You eat primarily carnivore diet. Give me the framework. What are you still currently doing so we can kind of set that, and then we'll go into carbohydrate specifically.
Yeah. So probably the framework for this carbohydrate article was, so 2017, I started doing basically all meat. I transitioned into it probably by mid 2017, was eating basically just meat. The rest of 2017, all of 2018, through 2019, that's when I started writing this article. And through that, I talked about, I did 6 months just beef and water, 6 months nose to tail, 3 months, I did like a bodybuilding kind of protocol, which was just meat, but I just ramped up what I ate. I did a cutting protocol, which is meat. But basically, it was 2+ years of no carbohydrates besides what little amount I might get in liver or something like that. And, I wrote all about this journey and why I'm doing it and kind of some of the science behind it and even like the ancestral point of view behind it. And without fail, people are asking me about carbohydrates and what I thought would happen. I've done lots of different kinds of carb cycling in the past. And so I'm like, oh, probably this will happen. But I couldn't speak from any experience because it had been 2+ years. I hadn't eaten any carbohydrates, not even like a cheat, which people think is crazy. For me, it's pretty easy because I don't have a whole lot of the social influences or pressures that might make me deviate or anything like that.
You're an outlier for sure, because I enjoy my carbs too, even if I'm being antisocial at times.
It's something we could probably talk about, because like my girlfriend, she's a quote unquote foodie. She loves food and likes to go to restaurants.
Right.
And, so since that carb article, I have gone out and done, eaten some other things.
Yeah.
But up until that article, I hadn't. And so some of the questions I posed in the article is like, okay, so if I eat this jar of honey this week, what's going to happen? Like, are my muscles going to explode? I'm going to feel great. I'm going to have an energy crash. Or, one question that a lot of people have, I was curious about too, is when you don't eat any plant-based foods, so like basically zero fiber, you're obviously going to have microbiome shifts in the gut. And so, what if I go eat a bunch of fiber? Am I just going to explode? Am I going to have some GI distress or what? So in an experiment, I did 2 pints of blueberries, 2 pints and 2 avocados over the course of 2 days to see what would happen from that perspective. And I did a full cheat weekend with my girlfriend when we went on a trip. And so I kind of wrote about these experiments and carbohydrates. And so that's the backbone of the art with the framework for the article.
So after you did those experiments, then you went into writing about carbs, that was the kickoff for it. Okay.
Yeah.
So then start there. If you did those experiments, can you give us the cliff notes? Was each one different, or was it over or underwhelming?
So it was amazingly, I think what makes it interesting is how underwhelming it is.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So kind of an interesting dichotomy, because a lot of my assumptions were wrong. When I had the honey, I thought for sure, anyone that's done carb cycling before, you go 3 days, no carbs, and you have a cheat day, or that cheat day, appetite goes up, energy goes up, mood goes up, you feel like a human being again, and then didn't have any of that. So, some of the hypotheses are look, I'm so fat adapted. My muscles are pretty much full of glycogen. There was no my muscles weren't depleted. So there was no repleting. I didn't crash off the carbs, and I didn't have an increase in hunger really. And I think a big part of it is this, more so than I anyone likes to admit is there's real addiction with carbohydrates and sugars. And I think after 2 years plus of not having any, like that addiction was like, I slayed the dragon. Mm-hmm. And so when I had some honey, it was like, it was no big deal. Mm-hmm. So it was pretty not that interesting. So, but that was over the course of 1 week. And one of the things I pose is like, well, if I kept eating, it was 2 tablespoons of honey every day, how long before that addiction comes back? How long before I'm not quite as metabolically flexible? And so there's a lot of questions that are like unanswered, but from an acute influx of pure carbohydrates, it was like pretty like not interesting. And with the fiber is a similar story. So I had the blueberries and I had avocados and my GI was just fine. No change in bowel movements. I actually wasn't like gassy or anything like that. I was like, man, this experiment I'm writing about is super boring, but it's also interesting because like one of the big fears people have is when they eliminate fiber for a significant period of time is like, am I ever going to be able to go back to eat another food? And I do think, and something I have experienced is I do have, I would say, increased sensitivity to certain foods that I think aren't necessarily good for me. And I think it's a good thing where it's like the body's trying to say, okay, if you eat in a little amount, you're fine. But if you eat that in too much, I feel the pain a little bit more.
Yeah.
And I noticed things like one of the big things with this experiment was the cheat weekend. So I'm on the train with my girlfriend. We're going from St. Louis to Chicago and she had coffee and she sweetens it with artificial sweetener a little bit, not even a lot of it. And so I tried some of her coffee and man, I used to love artificial sweeteners. I was like, man, free calories, no big deal. Let's chug them. The taste of it was just, to me, was like almost like repulsive. Like I just did not like the sweetness sensation of that. And so kind of one of the big takeaways from this experiment was this increased sensitivity or just like intuition kind of with foods to be like, whoa, I got my sweet taste buds back where they're not bombarded with sugar all the time. You can actually taste what real sweetness tastes like. And so, yeah, and just like this whole relationship with food that, I thought it was not a bad thing necessarily, or I wasn't in a bad place, but I probably was in not a great place where my relationship with food was largely healed after a long time without carbs. Like, I didn't have the cravings. And one of the things I mentioned in the article is also on that trip with my girlfriend, I had some ice cream. And people that know me in my history is like, I'm not like someone that would take like a bite of ice cream and be like, oh, I'm done. That's good. Mm. Like I'm more like the kind of person that's like, all right, I'm going to crush like a half gallon. Like I'm kind of the all or nothing kind of guy. And so I had some of her ice cream on the weekend and I was like, you know what? Like it was good. I mean, cause I'm a huge fan of ice cream, but like, I didn't feel like I needed to eat like a caramel ice cream. Like, so it was interesting how, I didn't realize how much of an improvement I had with the relationship with food, which I actually think is like the underlying problem with a lot of nutrition or diets these days is this underlying relationship with food. Because even when I was like eating a quote unquote healthy diet and doing like, lean meats and a lot of vegetables, even in like kind of like the bodybuilding days, carb cycling, things like that, there was like, I had this weird thing, which I thought wasn't that weird, but now looking back on it, it is like, I wouldn't feel satisfied unless my stomach like hurt. Like I ate so much where it's
back
like,
then.
Yeah. And now I'm like, how insane is that? I wouldn't feel satisfied until I'm like, all right, I'm in physical pain. Like that means
it's the food. I'm like, it's the food too.
It is, it is the food and it's the food. And exactly right.
Yeah.
Because the carbs, the sugar make you want to eat more. Maybe not just for, a dopamine hit. Sometimes it's because there's inadequate protein and the body just wants more nutrition.
Yeah,
there's a lot of factors in it. But I'm like, you know what? I thought I was already in a pretty good place going into this all meat diet. And really, I was like, I wasn't even that good of a place. So that just makes me think of like a lot of people that haven't really focused on nutrition for very long or probably have a lot bigger gap that could be fixed.
Yeah. So a couple of things to unpack here. The one thing about the sweeteners is interesting. It made me just realize if you think about a company developing an artificial sweetener for the market, what are they doing? They're trying to make something that is signaling sweet or a similar sweetness to what people's palate already is eating.
Right.
Right. So that's why when you remove the standard American diet and all the like the fake foods you have and the fake coffees and the fake this or the fraps with 60 grams of sugar in them, when you remove that, you get down to that like natural human baseline of like, this is weird. You put it in your mouth and you're repulsed by it because the range is so far off.
Yeah.
Right. So that's the interesting thing about that. But there was something you said about the carbs and your glycogen stores. I think we need to unpack that because that's an interesting way to think about it. So your theory is that because you were fat adapted, and for me, this type of science stuff I'm fuzzy on, so I like to kind of connect things in a way that makes logical sense. So it seems like when you're more fat adapted, you can eat fat and protein and fill glycogen fast, like efficiently. Whereas if you're just trying to cycle and do the things you're talking about, you're probably not as fat adapted. So that's why you have more of those highs, because your body's trying to like struggle to get glycogen or to get back to its natural homeostatic state. So that's probably why the carbs didn't affect you that much.
Yep.
Like, right?
That's exactly right. So if a standard American, semi-standard American diet person right now, meaning they eat a good amount of carbs and they work out, so they got some muscle mass, if they were just to cut carbs out for the next 3 days, they would notice their muscles kind of flatten, is kind of the word, because it's because they're going to lose glycogen. And then one of the reasons it's going to lose its glycogen and not replenish it is because those muscles are not good at using fat. And so your muscles will get better at using fatty acids. And so, and the other thing is you also replenish glycogen faster from protein stores the longer you do it as well. And so there is research, Dr. Voltec kind of unpacks some of this, where once fat adapted, muscle glycogen stores do like return to very much like a baseline. So you don't see the flattening of the muscles, then the refilling, they stay much more constant.
Because one's external base, right? One's like, I got to eat carbs through my mouth. Therefore, whatever I change with what I'm eating is affecting my internal chemistry and biology, right? But the other one is, well, we all have enough fat to survive. I think even like somebody with 10% body fat is like tens of thousands of fat calories, right? Or just on their body, right? Like you're good. You're good to go for a while. So because that, even for the leanest of people, can restore glycogen when they're fat adapted. So what are those actual mechanisms? I mean, there's like gluconeogenesis. There's a couple other ones. I don't remember which one's fat and which one's protein. But what are those pathways that people can kind of think about? Like, okay, if I remove carbs, I'm eating more fat and protein. I'm getting my body used to that. I'm basically trying to train these pathways to get into that, the ability to replenish glycogen without having to basically stuff my face with carbs.
Right. Well, some of it is you're just going to use less glycogen, like carbohydrate.
Use less as fuel, you're saying?
You're going to use more fatty acids as fuel.
And so then, ketosis, is that the primary mechanism, basically? The ketosis, and what's the other one where, I mean, what's the other method for using fat for energy? I think there's a certain mechanism it's called. I don't remember. But there's ketosis, right? But I believe there's another pathway
that
converts fat into energy.
There is another pathway called the Cori cycle, which you might be referring to. But overall, what it comes down to is you can break down protein or you can break down fat, and you can turn both into glucose and stores.
Fat being preferred, though, right? Your body doesn't really like breaking down protein. That's what, from what I've heard. But maybe you get better.
Well, you
maybe you got good at doing that.
What I'm saying is you can even like fat can break down and turn into glucose through the Cori cycle. And so fat can break down to fatty acids. You can use fatty acids as well. But you can also use, like, people worry about gluconeogenesis because you turn protein to sugar. Fat can also turn to sugar. So there's a pathway for that. Uses the glycerol backbone to basically do that. So you can use both protein and fat to restore glycogen stores. So those are kind of like the two pathways to turn other macronutrients into sugar, you know, to store glycogen. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you can also use glycogen from the liver, and that can go into the blood, into the muscles. But like once into the muscles, glycogen stays there and is used. It doesn't go back out into the bloodstream. That's the difference between liver, because if you store glycogen in the liver, it goes out into the bloodstream, right?
So your body can use glycogen liver stores as energy, but it can't use muscle glycogen as energy, a different kind of energy.
Let's just make it simple. Like, let's say your bicep has muscle glycogen in it.
Right.
You can use that to do your bicep curls, but that muscle glycogen it's basically an irreversible path. It can only be used in that, whereas glycogen in the liver goes into the bloodstream, but glycogen from your muscle is not going to be pulled out into the bloodstream. It's going to be
just
used
for muscle use.
It's going to be used for just the muscle use. Yeah.
Interesting. Interesting. Well, you know, another thing people don't take into account is when you see people on Instagram and they're like fitness models, male or female, and they're like, this is what I eat. And you see these typical videos, like what I eat in a day. And you take people that are like sitting at home, not exercising, not going to the gym, and like, wow, if that person eats that food that way, I should be doing that. And I'm like, okay, well, wait a second. Most of these people live in the gym 3 to 4 hours a day. How much glycogen do they have on their frame because of either they've trained hard or they've had anabolic help? And so they have these massive stores of glycogen. So these people could literally eat 300 grams of carbohydrates a day and then also be in the gym for 3 to 4 hours and potentially burn all of it off. So and then this is why you see so much in fitness, the calorie deficit thing. Like it's all about calories in, calories out. That's the only thing that matters or whatever. You know, can you speak on that a little bit? Because I just love covering this topic because it's such a prevalent myth, I feel like.
Yeah, so it's one of the biggest, and I actually think we talked about this one of the first, our first time we chatted, was one of the big misconceptions I had early on for a long time is I confused fitness for health.
Oh, yes.
And a lot of times, if someone improves their body composition, meaning they build muscle and lose fat, that's going to improve their health. Mm-hmm. But you can get good body composition and not be healthy.
Yep.
And so it is something, you know, I fell into that trap where I got a really good body composition, you know, naturally. I was doing natural physique competitions, but I was not nearly as healthy as I am today. Mm-hmm. And so part of, like, if we talk about macronutrients, is mostly carbs come from plant-based foods. You can get fats from plants and animals. You can get protein from fats and animals. And those are not equal. So kind of like you're alluding to, calories aren't equal, but fats aren't equal and proteins aren't equal. So a lot of times, you know, it's very popular, at least in the fitness circles, was if it fits your macros. Basically saying, if you eat this many calories, this much protein, this much fat, this much carbs, you're going to get results, right? And if used in a short-term basis, a lot of times it's true. Like, there's this professor who did this study who lost a bunch of weight eating just Twinkies. But I mean, I don't think the point of his experiment was to say, look, I'm getting super healthy on Twinkies. Mm-hmm. But there's certain short-term things where if you manipulate energy surplus and energy deficits, you can get certain kinds of results. Mm-hmm. But, you know, if you lose 10 pounds.
And not everybody, though, too, at the same time. Well, there's people that do the Diet Coke, like starve myself 500 calories a day diet. They're obese and they quite literally can't lose a pound.
Yeah.
Right. So that's the other thing. They're comparing your metabolic profile to like somebody in the gym who eats a certain way. And then you're trying to say, well, as long as I do what they do, even though the entire machinery, it's kind of like saying, I'm going to look at like how to repair a Porsche to like repair my, you know, like my Toyota or whatever. Like, you're kind of working on completely different systems in a way.
Yeah. You know? I mean, that's a good way to put it. And a lot of times depending on what like marker they're measuring is, oh, I lost 10 pounds. But if that guy lost 10 pounds, like 8 pounds of lean body mass and 2 pounds of fat, like he did as a negative move, like for his body composition, even though he lost 2 pounds of fat. I mean, losing 8 pounds of lean body mass is not worth losing 2 pounds of fat, in my perspective.
Yeah, he might have 8 pounds extra or like some that he built up, whereas somebody that has almost none because they never exercise.
Yeah,
like, we just try to make these broad comparisons because humans are alike, but we're also very different in a lot of ways.
Yeah, and that example, he could be even more insulin resistant than he was, even though he lost weight. And normally you would, yeah, exactly. It's, I mean, a lot of times insulin resistance is one of the things I focus a lot on, or, you know, this metabolic dysfunction. Cause I mean, it underlies most of the problems.
Well, let's talk about that as a relation to carbs then. Cause there's actually a book that came out recently. I think it's Why We Get Sick. I've been seeing a lot of health influencers talk about it. And I'm pretty sure the entire thesis of the book, like I've read part of it, is just insulin resistance. And so people hear that and how do you take insulin resistance as a problem to how do I make different changes in my day-to-day life, right? So that I guess I can be more insulin sensitive and I don't have insulin resistance. Like, and why, you know, like unpack that a little bit.
As far as, I don't want to oversimplify it, but I think there's an easy way to start improving insulin sensitivity, getting rid of insulin resistance. And it comes down to resistance training, where you're building lean body mass. That's going to be a huge driver of increasing insulin sensitivity. Because the truth is, like, most people are woefully lacking in muscle mass. Mm-hmm. And to get to a point where you have a good amount of muscle to function and, you know, optimize insulin sensitivity, it's not even that much work you have to do to get there. So that's number one. And then number two is the carbohydrate issue. If you simply eliminate or drastically reduce, cut carbohydrates and eat mostly, you know, animal-based protein and fat, like that formula, that two-step formula is going to work wonders.
It is as simple as that, though, in some cases. I mean, people could quite literally reverse chronic ailments by just doing those two things. And I mean, I would put the nutrition part first because some people that I know personally people that they just won't exercise. Like, yeah. I don't know, like it's a mental block or whatever it is. Or as they age, you get more of that mental, like, I can't lift weights. I hurt. I'm in pain. Like, I deal with that with my mom. I tell her, like, mom, if you're sore in your muscle, right? Not like in a joint or some area where you're not supposed to be sore. Right. If you're sore because you just pick something up and like your lower back might have a little bit of, that's probably your muscle fibers tearing and they're going to grow back stronger. Yeah. That's also strengthening your bone density because you have to stress your bones, right? So it's like this, but it's this creep of like addiction to comfort. And some people just like have this weird identity thing where they don't feel like they're not a meathead. They don't work out. Like, that's a big problem in our society. I wish we had a solution for fixing that, but they're both integral, really.
Yeah. And to your point, I think you're right. And a lot of times if someone would only do the one thing, start cutting carbs and eat more animal-based foods. And I say animal-based foods because of what we talked about earlier. Plant protein, animal protein, there's big differences, especially in the branched amino acids and what comes prepackaged with it. And the fats are very different.
Fatty acids are way different, right?
Yeah, and very different. And we could dive down that path. But a lot of times, and this is just kind of go into behavior change a little bit, but if you do the one kind of keystone habit, fix your diet, a lot of times that is a gateway into doing other things. They're like, I'm feeling better. I'm sleeping better. I got some more energy. I might pick up some weight, so a lot of times, you know, just focusing on one thing, a lot of times a lot of other good things happen out of that consequence.
Yeah. Well, there's also there's research that shows that exercise has no effect on weight loss for most people.
Oh, right? Just straight up cardio. Yeah. I mostly caution people against it unless they're doing a physique competition.
Yeah. Well, if you think about even weightlifting to an extent, because I can see this myself. When I'm training hard, if my kind of mental state around the food choices I'm making isn't like at the higher peak, I'm way more likely to eat foods I shouldn't be eating, right? Because it's that like you wake up at midnight and you're like, man, I didn't eat enough calories. My body's craving nutrition. And I just go for like, well, we have cassava chips here that Allison likes, but I don't really usually eat these. I'm just going to eat these at night, right? So yeah. I've just learned, and this is me personally, some people are different in this way. I've seen that if you don't have really good food choice habits, you're going to overeat and you're going to overeat the wrong foods at the same time because your body's like, hey, feed me. You trained me. I need to be fed.
That is a good point. Because I mean, whether it's lifting weights or cardio, they both stimulate appetite. Yep. And if it's stimulating like the wrong food choices, you can do more damage than good. I mean, that's a perfect point. And one of the things that I think a lot about with carbs is I think of it on a continuum usually, like meaning like pros and cons. Mm-hmm. And for most people that have some degree of insulin resistance, the spectrum shifts over here where it's basically all cons. You know, the small amount of pros would be it tastes good for a second on your lips, helps with social situations. But from a health perspective, there's no real benefits coming out of them. Whereas for someone that is very insulin sensitive, that has goals of body composition, whether it's, you know, building muscle to the maximize or, you know, getting super lean and using carbs as a way to help preserve muscle, losing muscle mass. You know, I do think there's pros, but there's also cons that come with those pros.
Yes, it's a slippery slope.
It's a slippery slope. So it's hard for me. A lot of times people want blanket statements like, I want to fix my body. They want to fix their body composition. And I try and explain, like, carbs couldn't be an ingredient in that path. But for most people, they shouldn't be focusing on that path just yet. For someone that has been training for 5, 10 plus years, has a good body composition, is insulin sensitive, wants to build up a little more muscle, or wants to get super lean for a physique competition, I do think there's a strategic use of carbs that can help optimize that. And that's what people are always asking me. Like, they want to focus on this 0.01% of the time, where I'm like, you know, we could talk about that, but it is really kind of almost outlier situations where most people, there's some interesting, you know, evidence, some research that shows almost up to 90% of U.S. adults have some degree of insulin resistance.
I'd also surprise. I mean, if we're at 50% obesity, then we're at an even higher rate of probably overweight. Like, it's just...
And you look at, like, I look at the pre-diabetes, diabetes research and things like that, which paints an ugly picture. But I think the picture is actually worse than that, because a lot of times, like, we'll look at your blood sugar and say my blood sugar is like, let's say it's 85 right now, and I require just a tiny drop of insulin to keep it at 85. Well, there might be someone else who's not clinically pre-diabetic, their blood sugar is also 85, you know, postprandial, just, you know, fasted. We'll just say fasted.
A ton of insulin keeping it.
They use a bucket of insulin to keep it at that level. So some of it gets, you know, unless you're doing the right testing, a lot of this insulin resistance goes unnoticed. And the picture is actually, my point of view is, if you're using a bucket of insulin to keep 85, like, you already are in insulin resistance, metabolic dysfunction. Basically.
Yeah. And doctors, I don't think, test for that. No, that's the thing.
No, it is.
That's so part of the problem.
The picture's bad if you look at the stats, but I actually think it's worse than what the stats indicate. Because,
and that's why they're not really diagnosing. I think it's what he talks about in that one book, Why We Get Sick, is they might test something like glucose levels or some other things. And I guess they might test fasting insulin. I don't remember what the tests are.
Not commonly.
Yeah, right. Like, fasted, it's just they do that.
HbA1c and, you know, fasted glucose are basically the two standard ones, which give you an idea, but it doesn't give you, it's almost by the time that those are off, man, you're already in a not good state. And I think, you know, fasted insulin test, if I would say like one test, I would be like, that should be standard. I actually don't know why.
For it's everybody. Not.
Yeah. Because like,
yeah.
It helps much more predictive.
Right. And it's because, I mean, it shows you what is your body doing when you're not eating food,
exactly.
Right? And if it's out of whack when you're not eating food, what do you think is happening when you are shoveling food in your face? You
know? Like if you're fasted and your body's pumping out a lot of insulin. Yeah.
Yep.
Like that's already not a good situation because, you know, you shouldn't need that much insulin to keep, you know, fasted baseline homeostatic levels, right?
Yeah. Yeah. So there's so many different ways to go with this. I'm trying, like something that you just said that is good is we keep talking about insulin. We're talking about glucose. The one thing that you brought up when you said your blood sugar could be at 85.
Yeah.
Now, do you know how the levels work? Because I remember a quote specifically by Mark Sisson saying that your body maintains about 5 grams of glucose at any given time.
Yeah.
How does that 85 number connect? Is that like a milliliter? Like I know there's some like ml level where it converts. But it's 5 grams is about what most people try to maintain.
So the units on the blood glucose are nanograms per milliliter, I believe, but I have to double check that. But you're right. There's like a teaspoon of sugar in your blood at any given time. Like it's a very small amount. And we eat 130 pounds of sugar on average a year. So if you just think about it.
If you drink a Coke, like it was like 50 grams now, 60, I don't even know, like a small Coke, 50. This is how I think about it. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe you can correct me by like talking about some of the pathways, but you flood your system with 50 grams of sugar, right? Obviously some of that will go to fructose. So that goes to your liver. So let's say maybe 25% is left over as just glucose flowing around. Well, this is what happens. Your body's like, okay, wait a second. We have all this extra glucose. This can't be in the bloodstream because we're only supposed to have our 5 grams.
That's where
the insulin comes in as these little dump trucks or like transport ships that then shuttle that glucose. Where can that glucose go? Fat or liver, right? Or obviously glycogen, which is another thing about like fitness people having such a different metabolic state that they could maybe have a Coke on a daily basis even. It could be bad for them, but they would not show it in their fat stores in their body because they have other places to put it.
Right.
And so, is that kind of a simple understanding of how that works?
It's really good. And it highlights one of the issues that I think does get not overseen. So and it kind of takes us into like this inflammation path because this chronic inflammation, low level systemic inflammation is like that and insulin resistance are kind of like if you look at the chronic diseases is what you see. You see insulin resistance and you see systemic chronic inflammation. You're like, where's that inflammation coming from? And one of it is coming from this intracellular mechanism, meaning, okay, so you got this insulin, it's trying to get this glucose into cells because it has to get out of the blood.
Right.
And so the body's going to keep pumping up insulin because it's got to get that sugar out of the blood. And the cells are like, we don't want it. That's why it has insulin resistance. But it forces it in, and the chemical pathways that process glucose in cells get overwhelmed. And when these get overwhelmed, it creates reactive oxygen species, or ROS, which basically are free radicals that are causing intracellular damage and inflammation from the cell inside out. And we also, there's one level of where this carbohydrate, poor glucose metabolism is causing a level of inflammation from an intracellular way out. And then we also get it from, you know, I think a lot of it, this systemic inflammation is originating in the gut. So a lot of these plant-based foods, not carbohydrates like themselves, but what comes prepackaged with the carbohydrates. And a lot of these foods cause issues in the gut, lead to what, you know, people call intestinal permeability or leaky gut, which stimulates the immune system. And so you get this low level of chronic inflammation, which is also correlated with insulin resistance. So, you know, those two paths from cellular inside out and outside in is, carbs doing a lot of damage.
Yeah. So that's interesting because now that makes me think of stress, which I think we should talk about next, but
yeah.
So this is how I'm trying to, again, I want to get like the simplest layman in terms of the way to think about these things, because I feel like when people understand these pathways, it does pop up in your head every so often. Like if you're like going to eat a huge bag of chips or whatever, you might like think twice, but it's like, if your body doesn't want to store this extra glucose and you keep flooding it with glucose, you get insulin resistance basically is what happens, right?
Yeah.
As a byproduct. Right.
Yep.
And so insulin resistance is basically the more these pathways that should work naturally, because they should have a kind of a measured level of carbs, right? And like, and our ancestors didn't eat very many carbs. And when they did, it was usually kind of in doses, right? And like, we might find a thing of honey and we would gorge, but then we wouldn't have anything for a while. And this was a survival adaptation, right? Or we had fruit in season and then it was gone for the whole year. So when we constantly do this on a regular basis, the extra glucose causes your body to like overwork and do things it's not naturally made to do, which creates some kind of, like you said, like a extra free radical or whatever. Like, right. You know, it basically like stresses your body beyond a healthy stress and you get like an overflow, which then leads to the chronic disease. And you do that for 20, 30 years, you get these diseases that is now that are now plaguing modern man and woman, right?
I mean, probably a great way to put it. I mean, it was perfect, right on. And one of the things that I think is worth mentioning is, because I get a lot of fear on, okay, you're saying eat a high protein, higher fat diet. And what about gluconeogenesis? But gluconeogenesis, like, it's been super demonized, but is one of the like most steady ways, because you need to keep glucose in the blood at this level, right? So we need to keep supplying glucose to the blood. And you can do that by, you know, trying to eat the right amount. Okay, that doesn't work.
Can you define it real quick? So gluconeogenesis, can you define that?
So gluconeogenesis is turning protein and fat, but mostly people think in the context of protein into glucose, right?
So, but is it mostly protein? Because I've always associated, I like when I hear that, I'm thinking protein breakdown, which is like the least efficient way your body wants to do it. Does your body prioritize fat, then go to protein, or is it some kind of like mixed, like will they burn protein here if it's extra, or like fat here? Like how does your body determine that?
Well, so gluconeogenesis is very, it happens at a very consistent rate. So like all the
it's
time,
like constant fuel, like you eat like, food, like constant. Your body, very much so.
Just like your bloodstream needs a constant level of glucose in it. Gluconeogenesis is happening at a constant amount, almost like it's just designed to steadily supply blood sugar. So it is inefficient to turn protein into glucose. Definitely, much more efficient just to, you know, eat the glucose itself. Mm-hmm. But just because it's inefficient doesn't mean it's necessarily bad, or you know, because it is happening naturally all the time. And if it was like inherently bad, it wouldn't just be happening naturally all the time. And it's one of the things that in the protein article I wrote about recently is like, I went into pretty good depth, probably more so than people would care to read about this gluconeogenesis pathway, turning protein into glucose, turning fat into glucose. Cause that's where a lot of the concerns come, especially from someone with a ketogenic background, which a lot of people have, you know, familiar with or tried and done it. They limit protein because they're afraid of this gluconeogenesis pathway, which, you know, can you eat too much protein? Potentially.
I think satiety hits in far before that, yeah. You know, but so why are they afraid of gluconeogenesis? Is it, I was under the impression that most people on keto are worried about not being in ketosis. Does gluconeogenesis somehow affect that?
So if you eat a ton of protein, it can decrease your level of ketones.
Because it can spike insulin. It's a little insulinogenic and.
Insulinogenic. Yep. And so, that's a concern. If you're on, if someone wants to keep ketones in a certain depth of nutritional ketosis, if you eat too much protein, it can knock them out of their depths that they want to shoot for. You know, a lot of times those people I'd ask, like, why do you want to be at that depth? You know,
that's the question.
In certain circumstances.
Medical grade? Right. Yeah. Like medical grade versus just lifestyle. Cause that's a completely different thing. You know, I think they sometimes confuse the forest for the trees.
Yeah. Yeah. So I'm like, what's your real goal? Sometimes if someone says like, look, I know if I'm in 1 millimolar, you know, nutritional ketosis, I have better brain function. I've tested it. I'm like, okay, fine. You know, whatever. But usually that's not the case. Usually it's because of a body composition. They're like, they think if they're in this degree of nutritional ketosis, they're burning more fat, so they're going to get to their body composition goals, which usually is not the case. That level of nutritional ketosis usually is overstated. So usually I would want to get to someone like, okay, why do you want to get that? And is that really giving you the benefit that you want? Like you said, sometimes it makes sense. People like certain cancers, epilepsy, you know, it makes sense to be in certain depths of nutritional ketosis. But for most people, it's not something to fear. And one of the other things they fear is like, cortisol. They think if you're in order to initiate the gluconeogenesis process, you need cortisol.
They don't like that idea because it's stress hormone, which can lead to fat gain. But I mean, cortisol also is in your body. Like it's how you wake up in the morning, right? Like you need it. It's a hormone, but it's just when you have too much of it, just like insulin. If we didn't have insulin, we'd die, right? Like that's what people don't understand. But if we have way too much insulin, we're going to die. It's just going to take 30 years.
Yeah. And I mean, the thing is like, I talk about it in the article is that you actually don't need the cortisol to turn on gluconeogenesis. So if your blood glucose drops to a certain level, the body doesn't want to die. So cortisol will spike and it'll release glucose from the liver into the blood to re-normalize your blood sugar levels. But gluconeogenesis turns on before that hits. Mm. So that safety guard, that backup plan, that safety guard is not gluconeogenesis is on before that. It doesn't require require that to turn on. And so there, a lot of the fears around it are largely unfounded. Even people that, like, there's this people that you, like, the maximum limit of protein you can eat is 40% of your calories, which I've eaten way more than that. So even some of these things that people think it's a kind of like nutritional dogma, it's like, I question that, because I eat more protein than most people that eat meat-based diets. I probably eat at least 40% of my calories from protein on a
daily basis. Yeah, and that's at the higher end. I mean, there's hunter-gatherers have been observed, 55% is the highest I think they've found.
Yeah, something like that.
You know, and but that was, and that's of course over a period of time. So that means they're consistently eating around half their calories from animal foods. And what you see is like a lot of the range falling like the 30 to 35% range.
That's the most common.
Yeah. And I feel like for me, getting to 35% range is like a slog at times. Like, it's a lot of protein, right?
It's a,
at least
certain
proteins, you know? And so, but I'm still aiming for that, because like I'm not afraid of protein. And I know that when I optimize it, I'm kind of balancing the protein to energy ratio. We had Dr. Nyman on recently and he talked about this, and he just, I love that idea of like protein versus energy.
Yeah.
And how to balance it and everything. It's a very simple, clean way. I recommend everyone listen to that show.
Yeah. And the book that he has on that. I read their book. They sent it to me, and it's a good book. Like it's a good book.
Simplifies it. A lot of graphics.
Really? Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It does simplify it.
So we were talking about carbs. We're talking a little bit about protein.
Yeah. But
let's, I mean, carbs is good though. I think we covered a lot of like insulin is connected. I mean, you know, carbs and insulin and carbs and glucose, those are the most important things to consider, right? Obviously weightlifting, lifestyle, stress, all those other things will affect everything. Insulin, cortisol levels, stress levels, and all these other things, and inflammation. But like the number one thing you said for most people is if you're eating 300 grams of carbohydrates a day, especially if it has a lot of seed oils and sugar and refined grains and other things that cause issues, in addition to eating 300 grams of carbs, like you're literally overloading your body with things that it has to process out,
yeah,
right? It's just like, imagine if you overdose on some kind of poison, they pump your stomach full of charcoal. It's always what I think about. So like that would have been on accident, right? And they're trying to correct it with charcoal or whatever. You're choosing to put 300 grams in some cases of poison, especially the way that some of these carbs come in our modern food system. Like some of them are straight poison, seed oil, vegetable oil, sugar, nothing good, nothing, no nutritional value whatsoever, no vitamins or minerals, right? You're putting that in your body on purpose. What do you think is going to happen? Like breaking down, you know? But aside from that, like, it's most of my listeners are probably going to be semi-health conscious. They're not eating Twinkies all day, right? Yep. So like you talk about, you get a lot of these questions. People are afraid of this, afraid of that. Like what are some of the most common questions around carbs and or like struggles? And like what advice do you give to those people generally?
You know what? I think I try to boil this down because I was like, what really is the concern? And I think the biggest concern for people is, well, one, they realize, okay, carbs probably aren't the best thing. The poison's probably in the dose.
Yeah,
which I agree. The poison is probably in the dose. And so when people are asking me about carbs, they're usually, especially if they're already health conscious, a lot of times already eating a meat-based diet. The underlying thing that I think they're trying to get at is, how can I eat this meat-based diet and have it fit into my life?
With carbs, like have some carbs.
Yeah. Exactly. Because a lot of times people are like, I want to eat healthy. I want to do the right thing. But if I can't go be a foodie, if I can't have cake at my son's birthday party, if I can't have a glass of wine on an anniversary, you know, it's like, how do I make carbs? How do I allow for carbs to be into my life?
And not without, also gain weight.
Without undoing all the benefits, exactly.
Right. And not either gaining weight or how to get to my next level weight loss goals, right? Like, it seems like that is probably common. I mean, you have some people that want to feel good about their choices. They're already lean. I know those people, like, where they're so obsessed about anything they eat because they don't want to, like, they think it's just going to destroy their health, right? Like, but there's a quote that I remembered earlier as we were talking, old quote, 1700s or whatever, but he basically said the physically fit can enjoy their vices. And I always took that quote to not say you should get physically fit so you can eat crap food. I always took it to say, for me, if I eat this ice cream or if I binge on this thing here and there, I don't need to obsess about it. I don't need to have shame and guilt around it, which is very common. And I don't need to have some excuse where I'm going to start my diet next week or my diet's ruined, so I'm just going to like basically do this forever, like all those really bad ideas that come up. So it sounds like that's probably a lot of that too.
You have a foundational structure and small deviations off the foundation aren't going to have long-term like negative consequences.
Sometimes have benefits too, hormetic benefits.
And if you keep that foundation in place, then a lot of times you're good. One of the things that I quote, there's this guy, I want to say maybe it's Clayton Christensen, but whoever it was, he said, well, for him, 100% is easier than 98%. Meaning, you know,
For some people, that's
an example. For me, like with alcohol, I don't drink, and For me, the opportunity to drink comes up every single week. You know, it's like, and it's just.
Were you a drinker?
Yeah, I drank throughout college and in the dental school. And in dental school is when I quit. And so that's when I started like doing more coaching and things like health nutritional coaching. So it's kind of a dichotomy. Once I got rid of that, it helped. But for me, it's just easier to say, you know, I don't drink rather than I'm not drinking tonight. Because if I'm not drinking tonight means I have to make a decision every single time I'm in that situation where it's like, I just don't drink. It's just easier. But yep. Not everyone, because the opposite can be not the opposite, but the other truth I think is that for a lot of people, 95% can be very doable as long as they don't have to be 100%. Meaning as long as they can have
one glass
like,
of wine yes, or like one drink or whatever that works for you.
They're like, as long as I can have, you know, that chocolate at the end of the night or that glass of wine or whatever, I can eat 95%, you know, solid all the time. Mm-hmm. But if you make me do it 100%, I'm standard American diet.
Just, yeah, that's totally fine.
And so there's a lot of self-awareness, I think, that has to come into nutrition. Yep. It's like, what kind of person are you? Like, and like for me, alcohol, I'm tend to be, I just like to make that 100% zero choice. It's just easier for me. But when it comes to nutrition, I've done it so long enough that I think I can do 95.5 and it would be no big deal because I'm not, once you kill the cravings, once you fix that relationship with food that we were talking about, it's much easier to pull off a 95.5 or 90.10 or whatever it might be. The problem comes
when you've been 100 for a while, you know, when you've been 100, right?
The problem comes when people are, they still have that. It's like the alcoholic that's still addicted. It's like, yep. Look, I just need one. Okay. Really one leads to right. 10.
They're still maintaining. Yeah. They haven't actually gone
exactly.
back to turkey.
So yeah.
Yeah. So that's actually a really good point. I'll give you my example for alcohol. So I never liked it. But I drank a few times here and there. I've been drunk a few times. You know, it was kind of fun or whatever. But it was just like, as I got older and I didn't see the point, I didn't want to spend $10 on a, you know, in downtown Austin, $10 for a mixed drink or whatever. Like,
yeah.
You know, and being an entrepreneur, I'm like, I know what that cost you, dude. You're not getting away with that to me. And then, so for me, it became easier. And almost a badge of pride is like, I don't drink alcohol. I don't like it. I have no reason to drink it for social reasons because I'm totally fine sitting here being myself. And so for me, it was a little bit of a reverse thing. Now, if I had any substance abuse issues whatsoever, it'd have to be 100%.
Yeah.
You know, like, and everyone's on a different range. Like maybe right. You could do one glass of wine. It doesn't ever lead to any binges or crazy things. For me, it wasn't that at all. It was, you know, more of a simplicity thing, even a little bit of an identity thing for me. And so, like I said, it became easier. I don't drink.
Yeah.
I don't have to explain myself. It doesn't matter. You know,
you hit on one of the huge things that is not talked about is the identity thing. When someone identifies as something, that's when real change happens. And so if someone identifies as like a non-drinker, it's much easier for them to stick with not drinking. The biggest reason why I stopped drinking was it was just so unaligned with everything I wanted to do in life because I could not justify 3 hours of fun or 5 hours of fun and give up the entire next day because that's what it was doing to me.
Crap.
It would just wreck me the next day or the next 2 days. And from a training standpoint, maybe even like the next 5 days, I'm like, even I had fun with my friends, like, you know, it just didn't justify it for me. And so it was just easier to make that identity that,
yeah, I agree.
I'm just not a drinker because it doesn't align with what I want to do in life.
No, absolutely. Right. And it shows you how much of the social pressure there is in our society where you have to like have a good reason why you don't drink.
Yeah, as if, exactly.
Because it's so freaking normal, right? But so the other point I wanted to bring up, I eat carbs and I've been eating more carbs because I've been doing carnivore most of 2020. I did like strict 60, 90 days, something like that. And I started like adding in certain things.
Yep.
And what I've realized is my relationship now to carbs and kind of cheat foods here and there is literally an enjoyment factor. No other thing. I'm not optimizing for weight gain or loss or this or that. Like I'm down to, and like, if I let it go too far and if I see some kind of fat showing up in the midsection, like if I look in the mirror and I'm looking maybe a little bit, not as lean as I'd like to,
right.
That's an easy trigger for me to kind of like down regulate. But again, this works for me. There's so many different levels here, but I think the point is also, I don't look at carbs as necessary for anything I'm doing, right? When I don't have any carbs and I'm just eating like straight fat and protein steaks, I feel completely fine.
Yep.
Right. When I have a little bit of carbs and whatever, I feel completely fine. And then when I do a little bit too much carb, I don't feel good and I don't look as good. And then I kind of like have that, it butts up to the upper limit and then I have to readjust, you know? And it's like, but you have to get that point. Like it takes a long time.
Yeah. And what's interesting that I've seen is everyone has, like, I call it the thermostat. And you have that thermostat where you see, like, look, I just saw, maybe sometimes it's a scale, sometimes it's the mirror where you're like, That's not me. It's the identity right. thing. And so that gets you back on. A lot of times people need to fix their thermostat to be like, they need to recalibrate what they want. Usually it's raise their standards a little bit. But yeah,
so that's like, connected to identity.
Like exactly. It is 100%. Yeah. That's why it's something that it's not talked about enough, which is if not the biggest thing for someone staying with a healthy way of living is you just need to identify with that healthy person. If you start identifying with a healthy person, then you'll get the results. You'll stick with it because you realize it's who you are, and then the benefits reinforce who you are. And yeah. So yeah. I'm with you. Like when I think about carbs, I think about it in two ways. One is as a supplement for training. And that's only in specific times for specific people trying to get specific goals. So it's really that outlier case. But either as a I think of it as a supplement, not a food, or as an enjoyment, entertainment, like you just said. It's I don't think about it as like nutrition, because usually you're not getting that much nutrition out of it anyways. And it's like, okay, the dose is the poison. And so I've gotten smarter through some of these experiments to know which doses I can avoid poisonous toxicity, so to speak.
Yeah.
So I can have a little bit of this if I want. Like honey's a good example, because it doesn't have a whole lot of the phytotoxins. It has some, like some, but it's pretty pure source. It's got the sweetness. But I know it's like, look, I can have a tablespoon after a workout if I'm in a bulking cycle or severe cut, and I do fine. But if I have like a 1 pound sweet potato, that's too much, you know? So a certain thing, you learn to gauge, and everyone has different tolerances. And so it's, you know, I do think carbs can be, and probably are, a part of most people's diet. And one of the things that really turns me off is some of the dogma that people bring up a lot of the time, because it's very discouraging for someone like we were just talking about that wants to do 95%. But as long as I can be 90% carnivore and 10%.
They'll tell you it's not. They'll say it's not carnivore.
And then people
did this.
Exactly. Yep. And to me, it doesn't matter, but a lot of people need that feeling of community and that identity to identify, like, just let me identify as something, and it helps stick with it. But, you know, some of the dogmas ostracizing people and making success harder. And so. Yeah.
Well, we can fix that. I mean, you should write about it. I'll do videos about it. You know, we're doing podcasts about it.
So I started to notice that one of the impetuses for the carb article that I wrote a year ago was that. And
to open it up a little bit.
Yeah, to open it up a bit more. What's interesting is, so Dr. Paul Saladino started talking about more carbohydrates.
Well, he's doing honey now, right? And it's funny, it's such a sway. Everyone's like, Saladino's doing honey? I could, like, should I do that? Can I do that? Like, it's just so funny.
It's funny. It's interesting. Because within the small carnivore community, then it creates divide. But I don't know, because I don't know what, I need to talk to Paul about where he stands. I don't think he makes it sound like you have, but sometimes when Paul says something, it's like, look, in order to optimize your diet, you have to have honey, you have to have organs, you have to have this, this, and this. And then people are like, holy shit. It becomes a lot when I'm like, that's not ancestral eating, right? If you have to,
like, optimize everything, right? We couldn't have done that in nature.
So I like to not have like, oh, you have to eat carbs, but I think you can eat carbs and still very much thrive. And so, you know, some of this dialogue, I think, is probably hopefully helpful for some people.
Yeah. Well, I think it's a good place to wrap up. We hit about an hour. I will have links to the carb article. I also want to read that protein article, so I'll have to get that from you. And where can people learn more about you and what you're doing?
Just, you know, I write a weekly newsletter, and that's kind of where I recap if I have anything, you know, if I created anything or just other interesting things I found during the week. But I usually put the best stuff in the newsletter, which is called the Saturday 7 newsletter. And anyone,
how do you get that?
It's free. It's on my website.
Is it meat.health still?
Well, I mean, you can sign up at meat.health, which is all kinds of free guides, anything from getting started to a carnivore diet, to fat loss, to, you know, health danger of a plant-based diet. And my website is just kevinstock.io, where you can sign up for a newsletter, read articles, read the latest protein article.
Yeah, it'll only take you a few weeks to read it. It took him 9 months to write it, and it took you 3 weeks to read it.
It'll take you an hour to read it, maybe, but it took me 9 months to write. Man, that's why I love books. I'm a book, like, reading addict, because I'm like, someone spent their last probably 10 years writing a book, maybe their whole career.
Well, and learning about it their whole life, then putting it into a book.
Exactly. Yep. I'm like, you get someone's life experience in a few hours, like, that's invaluable.
Why I read lots and lots of audiobooks, and I've been hitting 100 books a year for almost 5 years now.
That's impressive. I'm probably maybe half that.
Yeah.
All right, I got to get on your level.
You need audiobooks, because, like, you know, I can walk and read, or I can drive and read. Like, you can't replace that. I'm not, like, sitting in front of a Kindle or a book for like 5 hours a day. Like,
yeah,
as much as I want to, I aspire to that. But Kevin, I appreciate you coming on. This has been a blast. And then, so maybe protein round three, we'll talk about protein when that comes out. We talked about it a little bit, but
yeah, there's a lot. There's a lot more on the protein that we could dive into.
More protein. But you know, before we break, what are just a few quick rapid fire like ways to think about this? Because I feel like most people need to eat more protein, need to like obviously watch the carbs like we talked about, and then modulate fat based on goals and whatever. Right. Yeah. So like within that realm, like what are just some of the rapid fire kind of takeaways from kind of the carb and just general, you know, how to be a flexible carnivore, for example?
Yeah. I think the biggest takeaways are, one, create the foundation first. If you don't have the foundation, then you're going to be in trouble when you start messing with carbs, because carbs do make things more complicated. But if you have a solid foundation, you can start playing with carbs. But that foundation is this relationship with food. And you can step down into that, like slowly eliminate things. You can dive right into a meat-based diet. Different strokes for different folks, but build a foundation that's a quick bite on animal-based food, right?
Yep.
High protein, high fat, little carb, to all the way to no carb until you really kill addictions. From that, testing carbs. See what works, see what doesn't. The best thing I would recommend is starting with single ingredient whole food plants. Fruits, you know, roots, which would be tubers, things like sweet potatoes, see how they affect you and see how much like a little bit versus a lot of it. Because once you have that foundation, you'll be able to have a much better sense of this food's okay.
Yeah,
this
you know how your body responds.
Exactly. A lot of times when you're already when there's all kinds of problems, you don't even realize those sensitivities.
And single ingredient, you said, what do you mean by that?
Single ingredient would be like, you know, if you have a grape, that's one ingredient, right? You can go pick it off a tree, a piece of broccoli.
Versus like a bar that has 20 ingredients exactly. Or some other thing.
Exactly. I mean, when you start eating anything that you're going to buy at the grocery store that's not like on the outside, like it's got an ingredient list. The ingredient list, well, first of all, if you have a problem with it, you're not going to know like, oh, what was it? You know, like what was the ingredient? And I mean, if you're eating single ingredients, like you're not eating processed food, right? You're eating real food, I'll call it. And then if people want flexibility, just objectively assess how does that flexibility affect your life positively and negatively. Like if it makes more enjoyable this aspect of your life, that's important. But if it wrecks you like alcohol does for me for an entire day, objectively upset, you know, take an assessment of that, because that's something I want to do on a regular basis. And then I am a true believer in most people need to put on a little bit of muscle mass. And I think that, well, especially if there's already degrees of insulin resistance, you know, if you want to start getting back into real health, muscle mass, low carb for a while, build that foundation. Those would be the two sound bites that I would really, you know, focus on.
Yeah, that's great. And to reinforce what you're saying about people need to build it for themselves, from themselves.
Yeah.
They want to listen to Colin or Kevin or whoever, or some fitness celebrity, and they want that person to say, this is what you should do.
Yeah.
Right. But it's like, how the hell are we supposed to say what you should do? Like, you know how many variables you and I just talked about personally about like why one of us might do this or might do that. We may not both drink alcohol, but the reasons why are completely different.
Right.
So if I took your reasons why you don't drink alcohol and I put them into my life, that just wouldn't work, right? Yeah. You understand what I'm saying? And that's what people are trying to do. They're trying to take something somebody's doing, no idea of the reasons why. And literally that's really why humans do anything is the why, right? Yeah. You have to figure that out for yourself, you know?
You do. One of the questions I get all the time, and it used to be a pet peeve, but I understand where it's coming from, is people like, well, what do you do? And I'm like, I'll tell you what I do, but
why I do it's probably more interesting.
Why I do it, or if you should do it, like just because I do it. I'm like, unless you're like a male in their mid-30s that's trained most of their life, done low carb their whole life, has the same goals as I have, same kind of basic intolerances, it may make no sense. Like just one quick example is, after about 2 years of eating just meat, I did some blood work and my ferritin was high. Okay. Ferritin stores iron in your body. And it was like the one outlier lab I wasn't really sure about. I was like, man, I don't know why that would be high. It's usually high because of a secondary inflammatory thing. I'm like, man, I'm not inflamed at all. I did CRP testing. It was like undetectable, no inflammation. And one thing led to the next. I got a genetic test. I have hereditary hemochromatosis, which is basically a genetic polymorphism that makes me more genetically prone to excessive iron absorption. So I had cut out coffee, but I brought coffee back into my diet with a little bit of cream because that can help inhibit some iron absorption. But that doesn't mean I'm telling people to go drink coffee with cream, because I think a lot of times it can be negative for most people. But it's the 100%. Context of, I mean, that's kind of an outlier example, but to drive home the point is what I do is not necessarily, probably not what everyone should do.
Right. And you actually just diagnosed your own health and you prescribed a medicine for your body. Right. Think about that.
I did.
Everybody understands that you don't take somebody else's prescriptions. I mean, that could literally kill you. Yeah. Right. Yet we like to think of food as just this blanket category. If I can just do what everyone else does and there's like one way to eat or whatever. And it's just not true at all. That's a great place to wrap up. So everything will be in links, and I hope everyone enjoyed the show. I think you got a lot of value here. Appreciate it.
Yeah. Thanks for having me.
Please always remember that the members of the Ancestral Mind podcast are not, in fact, medical professionals. They're not doctors. They're not nutritionists. They are simply providing this entertainment for you to do your own research and to entertain yourselves. So please consult a physician before changing your diet. Not everything works for everybody. And make sure you always do your own research on everything you hear on this show and outside.
Hey, everybody. Colin here. Thanks for listening to that show. I want to let you know about my newest podcast over at Escaping Fragility, a show about building a life for yourself, being safe, being secure, having a plan B, so that if this crazy world of 2020 continues or gets worse, which a lot of the numbers are suggesting it will, then you and your family will be protected. A lot of my content for my personal brand has been focused on giving people the knowledge, the expertise, the skills, and just the awareness of some of the craziness that's going on so that they can protect themselves, so that they can fight back, so that they can be civilly disobedient, so that we can stymie the ever encroaching spread of government and of corporate and political agenda. If more citizens do not stand up, fight back, speak up, there's going to be nothing left to protect. And I don't like fear mongering, and I'm generally an optimistic person, but 2020 has stressed me out. At first it didn't, but then it did. When I really saw what was going on, when I read a little bit between the lines, and even now, the craziness is continuing, and I don't see it letting up anytime soon. The masses are too easily manipulated. And so I'm more concerned what's going to happen in 2021 when the next flu season comes through and another coronavirus is weaponized, and then who knows what's going to happen. Travel restrictions, mandatory vaccines, chipped and prodded like cattle. People think it can't happen. They stick their head down, but they did in Mao's China. They did in Stalin's Russia. They did in Nazi Germany. And then it was too late. And who pays the price? It's always, always, always the citizens that are having faith and that are just hoping things get better. They're the ones that always pay the price. So the first thing we can do is protect ourselves and our family, have a plan B, have an escape option, and then we can help others. Head over to Colin.coach, get on the AM5 newsletter. You'll get all the shows every week. And you can also find me on YouTube and iTunes or Spotify or Google Play. Get prepared before it's too late.